You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is my longtime friend and colleague from Cage's longtime publishing company, C.F. Peters, Jean Capriolio. Jean was born in Manhattan, but is a lifelong resident of Queens. He has been playing guitar since he was 11 years old and has a BA in music education from Queens College. He is currently vice president for new music and rights at C.F. Peters. In his free time, Jean plays guitar and sings with the Bumper Crop Boys and also hosts a jam session at the Wild Goose in Woodside, New York. The Bumper Crop Boys have released a CD, Caretakers. To be apprised of Jean's latest musical exploits, friend him at Facebook. So welcome to All Things Cage, Jean. It's so great to have you. I feel like you're one of those people that I feel like I've known for a really, really long time, but I honestly don't think it's been all that. So when did you come to Peters?
1978.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I haven't known you since then. When did you come? Let's see. Well, this will be like 20 questions. When did you come into the position that you're in now?
That would have been approximately 2000, I believe. It was when Don Gillespie left. I took Don's place. And that's when we probably started being in contact more regularly, I think. Yeah, Don Gillespie was the vice president of C.F. Peters. I think he was just vice president. I don't think he had any other title, but he was the coolest guy at the company. And we moved to Queens, and Don just could not commute to Queens. So he retired early.
Yeah. But it wasn't that early, right? It's in the sense that he hadn't thought to retire, but he wasn't that young when he retired.
No, he wasn't. He might have been 62, 63, something like that.
Yeah. Well, that's still a long time. So I've known you for 21 years.
I would think that's about right. Yeah. I don't remember exactly when we met face to face. I'm not sure.
Nor do I. When did your CEO, Nicholas Riddle, come in relative to that? Was that before that or after that?
It was before. I think Nicholas might have come in 96, 97. I'm not sure of the exact year when he took over as president. But we did stay in Manhattan for a few years after he became president. And then we were on Park Avenue South, as you might remember, 373 Park Avenue South.
I do indeed. You were the only, people I ever visited on Park Avenue South.
And it was within pretty easy walking distance of Cage's apartment. So Cage was on 18th and 6th, right? Yeah, 18th and 6th. And so he could walk over in 10 minutes, probably 15 right. minutes max. Yeah. We were there at 373 for maybe 3 years with Nicholas. And then the dot-com bubble was forming. And they came in and were paying exorbitant rents. And we got pushed out. When I first started at Peters, we had three floors in 373 Park Avenue South. We even had an interior staircase that went up from the fifth floor to the sixth floor. So we didn't have to take the elevator. We could just go in from within the company, and we would go up. And Mrs. Henriksen's office, who was the president, was on the sixth floor, and a couple of other, I forget everything that was up there. The orchestral department was up there.
Mm-hmm. Your state, well, in Queens. So, but you lived in Queens, so this was a reverse good move for you.
It was totally coincidental, but it was fantastic for me. When we went out to look at the space, it was like a dream. I couldn't believe it. But it really affected a lot of people who didn't want to come out to Queens. There was a satellite office in Manhattan for a year or two. And when that satellite office closed, it was just a small office that like five people worked in. Mm-hmm. That's when Don decided to retire.
Right. And he went to Georgia, or did he stay in Manhattan for a while? You're not the first person to talk about Don. He was much beloved. But let me, I do want you to talk about Dawn, but let me tell you that I learned about Dawn long before I met him from John, because John told me a story about how he would come to Peter's to do whatever business with you guys. And there was this really quiet guy in the basement that Dawn was there, and he just took a real interest in Dawn. And it turned out that Dawn for him was the smartest, coolest guy at CF Peter's at the time. You, of course, he would have loved you more. I'm kidding. But you know what I mean? He really, really liked Dawn. And Dawn felt, you know, because Dawn was so retiring, he was so quiet, and he was so just, you know, he was like that. So he was not used to being paid attention to.
He had a really good knowledge of 20th century music. He did his thesis on Becker, John Becker, who was one of the American Five, which included, I guess, Cowell, Rager, maybe? I don't know who the American Five was. Charles Ives is probably in there. But yeah, he was one of those composers. And so Don, that brought him into the world that was adjacent to Cage. And Cage was actually involved in it. He was so closely associated with Cowell for a while. And when he came to New York, when Don came to New York, he was from the South. He was from Georgia. He immersed himself in the new music scene. So he was down at the Kitchen all the time. And he used to perform water music. I know, I'm not sure what else he did. He was a great piano player, but he didn't pursue his piano playing career. He got into publishing, and he was just fascinated by 20th century music. And he knew, you know, Philip Glass and Reich, Steve Reich. And he tried to bring Steve Reich to Peter's. And I remember we all went to see Music for 18 Musicians at the Bottom Line. And it just blew my mind. That was the first time I heard Reich, and it was just mind-blowing. There was a lot of really interesting things going on in New York City at the time. It was...
You're talking about mid to late 80s?
It was close to the premiere of Music for 18 Musicians. It might have been 79 or 80.
Right.
Yeah, and so CBGB's was going strong, and Max's Kansas City, and there was all that stuff. And then there was the Kitchen, and then there was this whole loft jazz scene that was going on with Studio Rigby. And so it was really an interesting time. And Don was really in the middle of that milieu, and I was to a certain extent. I was playing a lot at the time, and playing in some of the clubs. And so it was a very fertile and interesting place. And Don was a champion of all of the new music that came into Peter's. He didn't really have, he was pretty altruistic in that respect. He would treat Babbitt and Charles Warren the same as he would treat Cage. Although Cage and some of the other composers, Lou Harrison, were more fond of Don than the Uptown guys were. So he became closely associated and had a lot to do with, anyway, that I guess briefly that's what Don did. He did what promotion he could for Cage. Not that Cage needed a lot of promotion, but he would do as much as he could for any of those composers, helping to get their music out into the world.
Right. And Cage was not a popular composer altogether at CF Peters. I mean, he had detractors there.
Absolutely. I think he was largely misunderstood, like he was throughout the musical establishment to a large extent at a certain point. After, I guess, what was it, 1950? When he went to the chance operations, he lost a lot of people. Things he did up until that point were pretty much accepted. They were done at the Metropolitan Museum, and he was able to get his music performed. Once he went into chance operations, he was into a totally different area. It took people a long time to catch up with that.
Right. I love
and
that.
4 minutes.
Have you ever seen that? It's on YouTube. It was on YouTube for a long time. I don't even know if it's still there. It's a Boulez clip where he says something really disparaging about Cage with regard to, I think he calls it that Buddhist stuff or something like that.
They were like pen pals and pretty close and promoted each other's music. And
until...
then when Cage... Was it 1950? I guess it's around 1950, right?
It was 50-51, because it was Music of Changes, basically, was the piece.
Right, yes.
Yes, and you know, I did a bit of reading about that after the fact, and you know, in their correspondence, Boulez and Cage, Boulez loved Music of Changes until he found out that it was composed by chance, and then he didn't like it at all. So it had nothing to do with the music itself. It just had to do with the idea that you would sublimate your personality, you know, to whatever, to write a piece of music.
Yeah. I can see why people were thrown for a loop. And the amazing thing to me is that then in 1960, he comes to Peters, supposedly by opening a phone book and closing his eyes and putting his finger down on a publisher with his eyes closed. I don't know if that is true or not.
I don't know either. I don't know. But it's, you know, I think he really wanted a publisher. He was really struggling at that moment to know how to disseminate his music, to how to distribute his music. There's even a very lengthy letter in the selected letters that ended up getting in there about different ways that a composer can go with regard to getting their music out there. And one way is a publisher, but there were other ways.
Well, I know that I'm pretty sure that Mrs. Harrison went to Mills College or had something to do with Mills College. And she might've been up there when Cage came through, but anyway, or maybe it was the Cornish Institute. I'm not sure which one it was, but when he went into the office in 1960, Mr. Henriksen had the wherewithal to say, oh yeah, we want to publish your music. And he really got behind it in a big way. In 62, he put out that really unprecedented for Peters catalog of Cage's music. You know, the catalog I'm talking about?
Bob Dunn full color. Yeah. It's a collector's item now.
It was phenomenal. And we are currently at Peters trying to find any of the archival material from that because we can't really find, you know, the mechanicals or anything like that. We're not sure. Someone brought up a question about a performance of Water Walk that took place in L.A. I don't know if he contacted you. He did contact you. From
the Cleveland Institute. We had. Yes, but he couldn't believe it. He said he just didn't believe it because he couldn't find any other corroborating evidence that it actually happened.
Yeah. So anyway, that Mr. Henriksen got behind it completely. So I would say that Mr. Henriksen was totally committed to Cage. And in 69, he died. I'm sure Mrs. Henriksen was still committed to him. I think the Europeans were really having trouble just understanding what he was about. It was difficult for anybody, and particularly, I can't imagine what it was like at that time. I mean, I went to college music school for 5 years, and no one mentioned Cage once when I was there.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing, and that was in the 70s.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was Queens College. I'll name check them on the record. No one mentioned Cage at Queens College from 1970 to 1975 when I was there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, not even 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which is really, I just consider it a flaw on their part. I think they missed the boat on that. You know, a lot of that great early music was done already. Now, I wasn't a percussionist, so maybe the percussion guys were into it. I don't know. But I was not exposed to any of it until much later when I got to Peters. And there was a whole bunch of people at Peters who loved Cage's music, but we weren't in the positions to do much about it at the time. Mm. But Don was, and Don always did his best to work with him. But all of the, there was that catalog. Mr. Henriksen also did the concert for piano in that deluxe edition on the heavy paper.
Yeah, yeah.
That was in the box. I think it was a numbered set. And those are probably all collector's items at this point too.
Right.
We still sell that, but we do not sell it in that deluxe edition. And I know Cage and Mr. Henriksen went back and forth a bit about the cost of that, and Cage insisted on doing it that way. Mr. Henriksen was not into it. He might have even, that I don't remember for sure, but he might have asked for Cage to assume part of the cost of production. I think I read that somewhere.
There are some really funny things that you can see in his correspondence with Mr. Henriksen, which make you wonder how Henriksen had such patience. You know, because Cage would give away a score to somebody, or not, I don't mean give it away and not charge for it. I mean, let somebody else publish it.
Oh.
Yeah, there were a couple instances. There was another instance where he had, prior to signing with Peters, he had developed some kind of subscription donation service wherein his friends would give him money to buy a share of a composition, so that when it did get published, John said, by the way, Walter, you know, these poor people own a piece of that work. And he offers very kindly, Cage does, to handle that he doesn't expect Walter to figure out the shares and pay people directly, that Cage will do it. But it's just really funny when you read it. You think, Henriksen, I'm amazed Henriksen didn't fire him, you know, at every other turn.
He must have been getting good feedback from somewhere, because there was always interest in Cage's music. If you look in the early correspondence, there was always people writing in. It wasn't people from the New York Philharmonic or from the big organizations at that time. They subsequently did show interest. And, you know, Bernstein did those famous performances where the orchestra destroyed Cage's microphones and pissed Cage, angered Cage off to the point where he, in the future, he put instructions in about the orchestra and how they had to rehearse it so many times, and if they misbehaved they should just leave. He was unhappy with that whole experience, which is understandable.
You don't think that it was Mrs. Henriksen who had, you know, what's that old expression, the man is the head of the family and the woman is the neck, and we all know that the neck turns the head, or whatever that expression is.
I do. You know, I've never seen any record of it, but I have a feeling that she probably did have something to do with bringing John to the company and helping to, helping Walter to understand and perhaps, you know, he was from Germany and she was from California, right, like Cage. So
need we say more?
But somehow or other he managed to deal with it, and Cage turned out to be to this day the most successful composer Peters has, certainly the most influential.
Yeah, I think it was Nicholas who told me that about Mrs. Henriksen having such enthusiasm for Cage. But I think that I remember John talking about Mrs. Henriksen with great fondness, that he really enjoyed her as a person. Now, John was very good at this. He may have, you know what I mean? He may have sensed that, what's that old, another expression, God, I feel like, you know, some old woman giving you advice or something, but that expression about, if you want the calf to marry you, get the cow to love you, or something like that. So Cage may have really seen something about Mrs. Henriksen's influence on Walter, because he knew that Walter was the businessman. He was going to need to deal with Walter. So he knew the way to Walter's heart might be through the wife, maybe.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Were you really fond of Mrs. Hendrickson too?
Oh, I love Mrs. Hendrickson. Everybody she was the greatest.
Did. If I say that to anybody at the company, they all say, oh, yeah.
She would give birthday presents to my son every year. She would always give us tickets to concerts. She would take us to concerts and take us to dinner at a fancy restaurant beforehand. Huh. She was a lovely person. And she was genuinely interested in us. And I say us because there was a bunch of young guys there, you know. I mean, I don't know how old Mrs. Hendrickson would have been at the time, I guess in her 60s. And, you know, I was in my 20s. And she was very kind to me always and interested in what I was doing. And
that's so great.
Interested in my family. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I mean, but Peter's is a family enterprise, right? I mean, it's,
you know, they always called it the Peter's family, they took fairly good care of everybody as best they could. You know, I mean, it never was a gigantic money making operation, despite what people might think.
Right,
music publishing is a very marginal money-making enterprise. I remember we started making bobbleheads of composers at one point.
And that was your biggest profit margin was your bobbleheads?
Did I say this to you? Yes.
I was guessing where you were going.
Roger and I were working out, Roger McLean, who was the president of the company at the time, we were going through the budget for various, we had a project and a budget line devoted to each project. And you know, you could through extension go 5 years into the future. It was, you know, an Excel spreadsheet, basically. And we would look at the bobbleheads and we'd go, what, we would start making money after the second year, and we'd be making pure profit after the third year. And it was funny. And none of the music books, no matter how aimed towards the easiest beginners, would make that much money. It was a startling realization. Geez, I guess we should be making toys instead. But anyway. So I think it's pretty much that way throughout, at least the classical music world. Of course, the pop music world is different.
You know, I really think that you missed an opportunity when Nicholas actually sent this to me. I have a picture of it somewhere where somebody internal in the London office of Peter's made a 433 mask for COVID. Did you see it?
Yeah,
it was so cool. And I wanted one. And he said, no, we're not making them. It's just a one-off. And I said, well, I think you should rethink that.
Well, we did the bobbleheads. We didn't do a cage bobblehead because I said, no, can't do it. I'd love to do it. And in a perfect world, I would do it. But in a world where people still have a tendency to make fun of Cage, I didn't want to in any way support that kind of thinking. Yeah. So, but and we also thought Milton Babbitt would have been a good bobblehead, but for the same reason we stayed away from the contemporary composers. You know, so we did Beethoven and Verdi and Mozart and a couple others, and they made money for us for a while.
I see.
But and we also did the t-shirts. We did do the 4 minutes and 33 second t-shirt.
I have mine.
You know, you're walking around and you're doing a performance.
That's right. The Cage Trust made mugs of snippets from water music and snippets from the concert for a piano and orchestra. They're gorgeous. We didn't make a dime, but they're really nice.
We did Aria also.
Oh yeah.
We did one little thing from Aria, and I forgot what else we did. We did some George Crumb stuff, but that's because it's visually very interesting. But in the end, the only one that they still sell is the 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Uh-huh.
the Bang on a Can, people order that every year, and a couple of other places. But yeah, that and the we did the app. Have you mentioned the
yes, at great length. Larry Larson, our web developer, and I, he did the first ever All Things Cage program with me. So we talked about the app a lot. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll just briefly go over that. But
you I'm very
proud that we did that, and I think it was a great thing we did.
I wish it
was more popular than it is, and perhaps it will be as time goes by. Who knows?
No, it's gotten some beautiful, beautiful coverage over the years. And in particular, I would say the best coverage it got was when COVID hit, when people couldn't move, you know, when they were trapped, that it was like it brought the world to you. You haven't seen any of that. Oh, I'll ask Emmy.
I haven't. I was thinking yesterday to do one at the beach, and maybe I still will.
You should. Yeah. You did, for our audience, you did so we're talking about the app, the 433 app for the iPhone, and that captures a live performance of the ambient sound around you for you with your phone, parses it for you into the three movements, and it uploads it to a world map, and everybody can access it and see and hear what you've done. And Gene, you did a performance of 433 on the iPhone app in Cage's building.
Yes.
Yeah, you didn't go.
It was one apartment over.
Yes.
It was one apartment over.
It was in Peggy's apartment, Peggy Cosgrave.
Yes.
Who was way, way long ago married to Joey Malillo. He was a big, big guy at BAM. Anyway, she was married to Joey Malillo for a long time. And she lived next door to, she was one of the kind of legacy people in that building. And I think by the time we wanted to capture that recording and you agreed to do it, that the Cage Cunningham apartment right next door was at that time inhabited by the owner of the building's daughter or something like that. And so the apartment wasn't actually available. So you did it in Peggy's apartment, which is right next door.
Right. And she had a window right out on Sixth Avenue. So that was the place to do it.
It sounded exactly what it would have sounded as if it were in John and Mercer's apartment.
Right. I did one from Maverick too.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been to these kind of iconic places. I know it still goes on. And, you know, we still post, we still tweet and post on Instagram one selection each week of things that people upload that week. So it's still, you know, it still circulates. And every now and then we get some really nice words from somebody that they've just come upon it. They didn't even know it existed. And they write and say, I can't believe this. You know, somebody's doing such a cool thing.
Yeah. The other 4 minutes and 33 seconds thing that I did, which I'm really proud of, is the Centennial Edition.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Now yeah.
We're talking and, for our audience, we're talking about published scores that Peter's put together. We should talk more about these kinds of things, actually, while we're talking. But what Gene is referring to is a composite score of all three versions that we know that we have of Cage's 433, which is to say the tacit version, which is the one that's captured on the t-shirt. Each movement just says tacit,
right,
which I love. That's actually one of my favorite things, because tacit in that context is an orchestral word, meaning you be quiet while other people are doing things. So it doesn't mean silent,
right.
It just means you be quiet while they do their thing. And that's really very much what Cage meant, you know, with 433. He used to say there's no such thing as silence, you know. So it was just
right.
other people can talk too, kind of thing. So I guess I wanted to ask you, Gene, like, what do you, in your now 21 years in the position that you're in, what are you most proud of in terms of projects that you've worked on? And it doesn't just have to be Cage, but you've done some beautiful Cage things. I mean, you did, for example, the Indeterminacy Performance Box.
I was going to say, that was one of the great things. And that That was in collaboration with you.
That's
you
right.
Basically, introduced me to
Eddie Kohler.
Eddie Kohler, a great guy,
exactly.
Who really did it.
Yeah.
For the fun of it, or for a hobby, or for reason, or
you know, Gene,
put it together.
Yes, but let me tell you how that all came about, because I'm very actually proud of it, in the sense that what had happened was I was trolling the internet one day and I came upon this indeterminacy website, and it was completely unconnected to us. It was just somebody was doing this and it had all of Cage's work up there. And so I wrote a snarly letter or an email to this person. And I said, what are you doing? This is a copyrighted work. You can't do this. He wrote back so sweetly and said, oh my God, I'm just the biggest fan. I'm so sorry. I'll take it down. And I said, not so fast. And I know this has really happened this way. And I said, what if we bring you into the fold and you adapt this website into johncage.org, adapt it into our website? And he said, I could do that. And I said, yes. And then you came into the picture, Gene. You and I started talking about this guy and his beautiful work. And Eddie then agreed to be the editor for a very small payment. You gave him, I think, a couple thousand dollars. And he ended up being the editor of that whole publication, which was based on his pirated, you know, his pirated website, which we now have at johncage.org, thanks to Eddie.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
That was beautiful what he did. He took, for those who might not know, there's a great recording, first of all, of Cage reading the stories himself that Smithsonian Folkways now has. And David Tudor playing concert for piano and at the same time. And it's quite beautiful. It's one of my favorite Cage pieces.
Me too.
So
me
when
too.
The opportunity, yeah, when the opportunity came up to do it, it was, you know, I considered it a great windfall, and it came out great. The photograph, who was the photographer?
James Clossy. Clossy with the cigarette on the cover, the cigarette smoke going off to the right. Yeah, it's a beautiful,
fantastic photograph. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think, Cage, you know, when he would read the stories, would smoke and drink wine. We thought that was a good photograph, and it really is a beauty. And it all came together really nice. And that's
wonderful.
That made money. You know, that made money, and it got Cage's work out there. And it had, those stories came from all of Cage's great books. Silence,
A Year from Monday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are some things from X, M. I think they're things from M. Anyway, yeah.
And some of them were not in a book. Some of them had not been written. I think some of them weren't in books at all.
There's, and, you know, the fact is that the Folkways recording only captures 90 stories. And those were the stories that are scattered across these books. But there are twice as many out there. And Eddie Kohler documents, it's all in that performance edition that Peter's put out that is available for not very much money, by the way. I mean, it's not an exorbitant thing. And it's got, it does the whole history of the piece in his print matter. He talks about where other stories come from. There are stories that were dropped by the road because they just were a little insensitive, or they were a little politically incorrect. Do you remember?
From a certain time. Yeah.
Yes, from a certain time. He does one with a Japanese accent, maybe baby. Remember, it's really funny. And off it went. You know, that's where he just disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, my hope with that always has been that people from the literary world would pick up on that. And I think they have in a weird way. You know, but I was hoping that people would use it as like teaching assignments, you know, with creating short anecdotal stories about your own life, you know, to using it as a basis for projects having to do with autobiography, maybe different ways of thinking about how to do that.
Yeah, when Gwen Dealey used to do the Cage birthday celebration down at St. Mark's, I did indeterminacy stories using my own stories.
Exactly, exactly.
And it was really fun.
Yeah.
And one of my friends played a percussion piece concurrently, so.
I remember.
Yeah.
Then Cunningham used, John would read indeterminacy stories to Cunningham's How to Pass, Kick, Fall, and Run. Usually with a bottle of red wine on the table, an ashtray, and chain smoke while the dancers were dancing on the stage next to him. It was adorable. Can't get away with that stuff anymore. But at the time, it was so lovely. It was just so lovely. Anyway, we're going to have to stop. Believe it or not, we're down to 1 minute. And we are going to play, by Gene's request, he gave me a short list of pieces that he loves. And on his short list was The Seasons. And I thought that might be a really, really nice thing to play as performed on Mode Records by Stephen Drury, who's a very beloved character in the Cage world. I know I'm close to him, and I think that, Gene, you are too, are you not?
Steve's great. Great advocate for contemporary music to this day. He works up at New England Conservatory and runs their new music ensemble, and he is a great advocate. Yeah. And his Cage records are terrific.
And he did this is a particular, the recording we're going to listen to is the version for piano, which was the precursor, if you will. No, the orchestra version came first, right?
I think, yeah. What people, I guess, should know is that Cage and Cunningham were commissioned by the forerunner of the New York City Ballet, Lincoln Kirsten, and I forgot the great choreographer.
I know, great. It'll come back, but there's a ballet society.
Yeah.
New York Ballet Society.
It was before they were called the New York Ballet and NYCB. Anyway, they commissioned it. This is the rehearsal piano part. Cage did a rehearsal piano part for them. And then it was performed with orchestra. So it turns out to be a nice piano piece. It's also fantastic for orchestra, and more orchestras should perform it. It's, as you'll hear, not a tough listen at all.
That's exactly right. My favorite performances of The Seasons in recent years, or years of memory, are Michael Telson Thomas, because he was a big fan of The Seasons, and he played it in his centennial concert for Cage in 2012. His festival was actually 2013 early, but it was the last of the great centennial programs. But anyway, he did Seasons, just so beautiful. Anyway, it's been a pleasure, Gene. I hope you'll come back and we can talk more about what Peters is doing now.
Yeah, love to.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Thank you, Gene.
You're welcome.
Now on to The Seasons, a work from 1947 that was commissioned by and created for Lincoln Kirstein and the New York Ballet Society, with choreography by Merce Cunningham and set design by Osamu Noguchi. Cage was assisted in its orchestration by his friends Lou Harrison and Virgil Thompson. The New York Ballet Society was the precursor of the New York City Ballet. And by the way, the choreographer with New York Ballet Society that both Gene and I were drawing a blank on earlier was George Balanchine, of course. We'll play it in the piano version in a gorgeous rendering by Steve Drury, a lovable and extremely knowledgeable Cage player and conductor. This is yet another beautiful recording from Mode Records, Mode 63, Cage Edition 17, The Piano Works 3, which also includes Cheap Imitation and As Slow as Possible. The latter, the original piano version of this work from 1985, which predates the now infamously enduring organ version, Organ 2, As Slow as Possible, composed 2 years later, and which has so far been playing at St. Bacardi Church in Halberstadt, Germany, for just shy of 20 years. Pianist Steve Drury is based in Boston, where he created and directs the Summer Institute for Contemporary Performance Practice at the New England Conservatory, where he teaches. He is also artistic director of the Calathumpian Consort, with which he often performs. As to the seasons, it consists of 9 movements with alternating preludes. It's a particularly sweet and lyric composition, and like the sonatas and interludes and the string quartet in 4 parts, which date from around the same time, the seasons is indicative of Cage's interest in Indian aesthetics.